It's not something I'm going to be able to do. And why should I try? I'm really good at what I do. Why shouldn't I just find somebody else who's just as good at what they do and trust them, as opposed to me trying to spread myself too thin and becoming a jack of all trades and ending up becoming a master of none?
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll. Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea here with Ryan Gibson. How you doing, man?
Good to see you, Tate. Good to see you in uniform.
I usually don't podcast in uniform, but as soon as we're done with this intro, I got a jet. We just had an amazing conversation with Jay Scott. Ryan, you want to tell us a little bit about Jay?
Yeah, I've known Jay for a number of years, probably 7 years now. And what I love about Jay is that he is a all-around investor. When I say all-around investor, I mean he does everything from stock investing, note investing, real estate investing. He's an active investor. He's a passive investor. He's written books about investing, four books to be exact. I think five, yeah. Maybe now.
I've got three of his on my shelf: Flipping, Estimating Rehab Costs, and Negotiating.
And Real Estate by the Numbers, that just came out 6 months ago, which I thought was a couple of years ago, but it came out 6 months ago. Time flies. And this guy, you know, he has really good stream of thought and just really thoughtful about investing, how he makes his investment decisions. We get into a little bit of renovating strategy and tactics. We talk about syndicating. We talk about multifamily. We talk about some things that happened recently in multifamily, that some deals gone bad, not his deals, but deals in the market he was in, and kind of the differences that he identified and why he didn't move forward with those deals, which is pretty cool. And yep. We just kind of wrap up with where we are in the economy. So pretty good episode.
I think my favorite part about the conversation is the depth of knowledge just demonstrates how, if you know what you're doing in the real estate world, you know, there's so much beyond stock market investing. There's so much beyond a 401k. And if you take the time to learn the skills, or at least just invest passively, you know, it's incredible to hear his depth of knowledge, because it demonstrates what an incredible industry the real estate industry is and how much is there.
And even go a notch up on that, we talk about what angel investing is. So if you ever hear about like what he's an angel, or that's an angel investor, we kind of get into what that is and the risks associated with it.
And how to get into it if you are interested.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get right into it. Tate, take us away.
Here we go. Jay Scott, it's an absolute honor to have you on the show. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thrilled to be here. Thanks, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Yeah. So, Jay, I don't know if you remember, but we met in 2017 at the Best Ever Conference. I heard you on stage. And to this day, I remember one tactic in negotiation that you said that stuck with me all these years that I still use today, which is kind of funny when someone counters you or something, you always give them like a weird number, like $89,715. And it's like stuck with me. Instead of giving them like a 90 grand or 50 grand or whatever, you give them that weird tactic. So thank you for that. I think you've saved me some money over the years. So
absolutely. And for anybody out there that's wondering why we do that, it's because it sounds like we put some thought into that number, and that number is actually meaningful. So make it sound like, well, I'm getting ready to sell an investment, and I've calculated that when I get paid out at the closing table, I'm going to have $95,368 at the closing table. That's what I have to spend. And it's much harder to counter a number like that, because it feels like that number has meaning than it is, hey, $95,000. Okay, he just threw out a number. Now it's my turn to throw out a number.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, to kind of introduce Jay a little bit, one word that I can think of when I think of Jay is talented. Talented, right? Author, writer, investor, family man. You're consistent, a good speaker, podcast host, and you've invested in like everything: angel investing, apartment investing, house flipping, note investing, like everything. And I think that's just really impressive. What are you most proud of out of all that stuff?
the family man. Okay. So honestly, I am, because that was probably the hardest of all of those things that you mentioned. My wife and I, we worked in the tech industry for a long time before we met and decided to get married. We were both in our mid-30s, and we were making a lot of money in the tech industry. And when we decided to get married, we realized that we had to start a family pretty soon if we were going to have kids, just because of our ages. And we had to decide pretty early on, like, who was going to be the stay at home, who was going to keep working. And we didn't like the idea of one of us working 80 hours a week and the other kind of becoming a stay at home mom or dad. And so we decided at the same time pretty quickly, hey, we're just going to give up our jobs and we're both going to kind of leave the tech industry, and we're going to figure out a way that we can kind of create work-life balance for us, put family before business. And so we had really no idea how we were going to do that. Real estate ultimately ended up being that vehicle, but we didn't know that at the time. And so basically it was kind of a wing and a prayer sort of thing when we decided to quit our jobs and figure out what the next steps were going to be. But we knew we had to do that for the family.
That's great. Tate, I know you're dying to jump in here. What did you want to jump in and ask?
Well, you know, Jay, you've done everything under the sun. I mean, since the last recession up until now, I mean, you've flipped houses, you've syndicated, you've angel invested, you've done all this stuff. What do you, you know, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time, you know, regurgitating the same thing that you talk about on other podcasts. It's like, what's next? What do you see the real estate market doing right now? What are you looking forward to? Where are you seeing opportunities? Like, what are you passionate about right now in business and real estate, and what fires you up?
Yeah. So when I think of kind of time blocking my life, I kind of break things into two. There's my real estate life, and then I do things out of real estate. And the things I do out of real estate, like we've mentioned, I like to write books. I love to teach. I do some angel investing. I invest in businesses. I do some advisory work for businesses. And so outside of real estate, that's actually the thing that excites me most. We've seen a lot of innovation in this space called prop tech, property technology. And when I say prop tech, think of companies like Airbnb or Zillow, those super massive companies that kind of focus on the intersection of real estate and technology. But there are tons of smaller companies out there, startup companies out there, that are trying to figure out how to improve the real estate industry through technology. And so I've been very fortunate, because I have a background in technology, that I've been able to hook up with a couple of those companies. And so outside of real estate, I do some advisory work, helping those companies kind of bridge that gap between the technology they're trying to build and make it actually usable and useful for people inside the real estate industry like us. So outside of real estate, that's kind of what I'm most excited about, that advisory work that I'm doing. Inside of real estate, I started syndicating about 4 or 5 years ago. And at the time, it was a difficult decision to make, because when you syndicate, obviously you guys know this, you're taking money from investors. And right. So now you have this fiduciary responsibility, meaning this financial responsibility to your investors. Mm-hmm. But you also have more than that. You have very much just an ethical responsibility, which is part of fiduciary. But I think it extends past just the doing what's right from a monetary standpoint. And so I knew that once we jumped into syndicating, that I needed to make a commitment to my investors. And it couldn't be something that I could say, okay, I'm going to try this out for a couple years, and then if I don't like it, I'm going to move on. I needed to basically make a commitment that I would see every deal that I did through. So when I jumped into syndication, I, both to my partner, to my investors, to my family, I basically made this commitment that I'm going to be doing this for at least 10 years. So my commitment is in that space. And so from a real estate perspective, that's what I'm doing at least for the next 4 or 5 years, without a question, whether I love it, whether I hate it. It's what I've committed to doing to my partner and to my investors. And so that's kind of where my focus is going to be for the next several years. Now, in terms of asset classes, we may expand a little bit. So right now we're mostly focused in value-add multifamily, meaning multifamily that exists that is underperforming or distressed. We've thought about doing some ground-up development in multifamily. We've thought about moving into some other areas, considered self-storage. We've considered RV parks. We've considered industrial. Nothing right now that at this point in the economic cycle we're chomping at the bit to start doing. But over the next couple of years, I can see us expanding a little bit more.
Yeah. And go ahead, Tate.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, you mentioned the economic cycle. First, I've got two questions there. First, why multifamily when you first started the syndication business? And when you say economic cycle right now, where do you see us in that economic cycle? Where do you see us going in the next 12 to 24 months?
Yeah. So the reason actually I liked multifamily is because when I started thinking about multifamily 2017, 2018, it was right when I started to believe that we were heading towards a recession. We'd been about 10 years out from 2008, the worst part of 2008. And so there was a lot of reason to believe heading into like 2019, 2020, that we were going to see a recession. Obviously, COVID came, we saw a very short recession and everything kind of changed and nobody was right about what was going to happen. But at the time, I thought we were heading into a recession, and multifamily is where I wanted to be. And not saying it's the only place. I know you guys are in self-storage, which is another great recession-resistant asset class. But multifamily is another great recession-resistant asset class. Typically speaking, while housing values can go up or down because they're based on comps, they're based on what your neighbor thinks their house sells for, what somebody who buys your neighbor's house thinks the house is worth, prices basically fluctuate through sentiment. And so being in the single family space during a recession, a lot of what drives recession is sentiment. People right. think the economy is getting worse, so they start acting in ways that makes the economy get worse, and values change. And for many parts of the country during a recession, we're going to see real estate prices either flatten or go down. So that's the single family world. In the commercial world, values aren't based on sentiment. Values are based on income. And as long as incomes aren't dropping, values typically don't drop. Obviously, there's this multiplier we call a cap rate, which has an impact as well. But for the most part, if incomes are continuing to go up, values are going to continue to go up or at least stay steady. And so if you look at the history of rents in this country, what you see is something very different than the history of housing values. Basically, with the exception of about 3 or 4 months in 2008, where we saw a flattening of rents, and I guess you could also, we should talk about the fact over the last couple months, we've seen a flattening and even a small decrease in rents. With those two exceptions, over the last 100, 120 years, rents have only gone in one direction. Rents only go up because rents typically are highly correlated to inflation, and inflation just goes in one direction. So commercial real estate tends to be highly recession resistant as long as occupancies stay up, as long as people are paying for that space, because rents tend to go up. And if rents go up again, income goes up and values go up. And so I wanted to be in commercial real estate. That's where I started. Then I looked at the different specific asset classes within commercial real estate. And there are 10, 15, 20 of them, depending on how you want to slice it. And looking at the historical data, what I found was multifamily tended to be one of the most recession-resistant asset classes. It tended to be most consistent asset class over the last 50 or 60 years. In fact, if you look from what we call risk-adjusted return basis, meaning the returns relative to the risk in the asset class, basically the peaks and the valleys that we see, multifamily real estate tends to be the single best asset class on the planet. Now, again, there are some other asset classes that are great during a recession. Self-storage tends to be really good during a recession. Mobile home parks tend to be really good during a recession. But when you're on that kind of the edge of the recession, you don't know if things are getting better, things are getting worse. Multifamily just seemed to be a great place to be. So that's where I went.
That's such a good answer, because I think that, you know, for our listener base, we're a bunch of airline pilots, military pilots with varying degrees of real estate experience. A lot of people don't have a ton of it. And, you know, the idea of investing into a recession can be scary. And, you know, if you've studied the real estate market, you've studied history and how valuations work, it's really not the case. You know, CRE, commercial real estate, is one of the best ways to decouple yourself from market cycles. So I just love that. Ryan, I know you're dying to get in here too. What do you got?
Oh, I have lots of questions. But I want to shift gears just a little bit on the syndication side. So you decided to go into syndication. That's a big deal, right? Because you go from flipping, note investing, basically handling your own money, and then you decide to start raising capital from investors back, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. What was the biggest takeaway in that? I mean, the number one thing where you're like, man, I, you know, really learned this, or I didn't think that this would happen, or, you know, because there's some people that, most listeners that we have are, you know, airline pilots, like Tate was saying, that maybe are just flipping houses or just doing, you know, their own deals or their own investing or managing their own funds. And maybe they're thinking, you know, maybe I want to try this someday. You know, what's the word to the wise here as a 15 year plus investor in the space?
Yeah. So there were a ton of lessons that I learned and things that kind of hit me that I had never really considered. One of the biggest probably was just what my comfort level and my confidence in my deals was. I got to the point where I was flipping houses, and we were very fortunate that I, over the course of literally 400 plus flips, we only lost money on one deal. But towards the end, it got to the point where we weren't really doing much analysis. And let's be clear. When I say we lost money on one out of 400 deals, a lot of people can look at that and say, wow, that you did awesome. But in reality, two things happened. One, the market was fantastic. I picked the best time in history to be investing in single family housing. So it would have been difficult after, let's say, 2013 to lose money on a deal. I mean, it was right. Easy to make money. And even from 2008 to 2013, I mean, it was pretty easy to make money. So I'm not patting myself on the back for that. It was the best time in history to be investing. But number two, it's an indication that I was probably being way too conservative. I was probably doing way fewer deals than I should have been doing. And looking back, my wife throughout, again, the 10 years that we were flipping houses was saying, hey, we should be doing bigger deals. We should be doing some riskier deals that have potentially much higher returns. And I was always scared to do those. And in retrospect, the fact that we only lost money on one out of 400 deals says we didn't take nearly enough risks, especially since it was with our own money. We should have taken more risks. We should have lost money on more deals. And so that was a big takeaway. But then moving into syndication, what I realized was towards the end, we weren't even really analyzing our deals. We realized we've seen this type of deal 100 times before. It seemed to work out. It's a good area. The numbers sort of seem to work. Okay, we'll buy it. We'll probably do just fine. You can't do that in the syndication world for a couple of reasons. Number one, you need to be able to sell the deal to your investors. You need to believe it. And if you don't believe in it, they're not going to believe it. And then number two, even if you can sell the deal like with your enthusiasm, your investors are going to want to see the numbers. They're not just going to take your word for something being a good deal. And so after 10 years of kind of getting really lax on our analysis and our due diligence, we had to go back to getting really serious again about our underwriting, our analysis, and our due diligence because we knew our investors were going to require that out of us. And so I basically had to get back into this mindset of I need to be rigorous. And after a couple of years of not being rigorous, that was a difficult mindset to get back into.
Oh, I love that because there's an airplane analogy. All right, you ready for it?
Yeah.
You know, complacency is what kills people in aviation, right? And so, you know, when you're making that leap from flying private planes, VFR day, not much to think about, jump in the plane, just you and maybe a friend flying somewhere, no big deal, right? But then you start, you know, an airliner with a couple hundred people in the back and you got a few things to think about, right? So definitely good segue there. So
yeah, and let me tell you something. I used to fly VFR and I never got past VFR, but I saw that complacency just in VFR flying and scariest flight I ever flew was I'm coming in for a landing and I'm still a good bit from the ground. And I basically went into a stall because I just wasn't monitoring my airspeed. I had done this landing on this runway 100 times and just wasn't paying attention. And yeah, that complacency can really get to you if you let it.
Yeah.
Well, this is what I always say about syndication is that it's like being a passenger on a professionally flown aircraft. So, you know, Jay, you are a consummate real estate professional. You know, as an airline pilot, I'm really good at flying airplanes. And I realized that in my career path, I wanted to be a passive real estate investor because I was not going to be able to put in the time, the decades of work, and you know, the study that it takes to get to large operator. And it was like, you know what? I'm happy being a passenger in the back on the real estate deals.
Yeah, but at the same time, I mean, we're talking about that analogy of being the operator, and as an airline pilot, that's what you are. You go from exactly what Ryan just said.
Yep.
You're the person flying yourself, and if you crash and burn, you're putting your life at risk. But when you become an airline pilot, it's just like becoming a syndicator. Obviously, it's a lot bigger than becoming a syndicator. But from the analogy standpoint, you've now put other people's financial lives or literal lives into your hands. And so that's a big decision. It's a big leap and it changes your perspective.
I love that. I don't think that gets talked about enough. You know, there's been this Wall Street Journal article that's been circulating. You know, we can talk about that on another show. But, you know, I think that people jump into the syndication world and start raising money from private investors without really understanding the gravity of that. And so that's great.
No, actually, Tate, I want to know Jay's opinion of that article. Jay, I'm sure you're familiar with the Wall Street Journal article that last week spoke about a syndicator that went belly up. I'm just explaining for the listeners here. If you haven't seen it, it's just a quick search on Houston multifamily will probably get you going on that. What are your thoughts on that?
Dallas, I think.
No, it was Houston. So a couple of the properties were actually pretty close to properties that we own in Houston. And so we've been following that story for probably, 6 weeks now since it originally happened. And yeah, it was a syndicator who was affiliated with one of the big gurus in the space. I'm guessing anybody that's familiar with multifamily knows this guru, but though I won't say his name. And he acquired a lot of properties over a relatively short period of time. And he didn't have a very good management team in place. He didn't have a good property management company in place. He tended to buy properties that were, when we say underperforming, they were underperforming for reasons that you can't necessarily control. It wasn't stuff that you could go in and easily fix. He bought in bad locations. He bought in areas that were highly crime-ridden. He overpaid. We looked at actually a couple of the deals that he purchased. So it was four properties that went into foreclosure. We had run the numbers on a couple of those, and he significantly overpaid. And then at the end of the day, he basically took his investors for granted. He tried to do a capital call about a month before the foreclosure. And luckily, the foreclosure went through before the capital call did, but his investors may have lost a whole lot more money than they did had they done the capital call. Yeah, and just to put a finer point on how bad of a deal this was, he got in at about 80% loan to cost. So, and it was less than
highly leveraged for anybody.
It was highly leveraged, and then the bank, after taking back the four properties, resold them, and they lost another 12%. So basically, between the purchase and the bank selling off these properties, the value dropped 30-some%. Again, I'm in Houston. I'm in these markets. Values in Houston have not dropped 30-some% between 2021 when he bought these deals and when they were sold a couple weeks ago. Values may have dropped 20% in that time just due to cap rate expansion. But that means that he overpaid by at least 10% if you look at the numbers. And so I think he just went in with this attitude that multifamily has been great over the last several years. And if I buy now, and I don't really need to do that much due diligence. I just need to convince my investors to put money in and everything will work out. And as we see, just because it has worked out for the last 10 years doesn't mean it always will. And all of us are struggling right now. All syndicators are having issues. There's nothing wrong with having issues. There's nothing wrong with having to tell your investors, look, things are tough right now, but you don't want to go back to your investors later and say, hey, it turns out we overpaid by 10%. That's a huge miss.
Yeah. And I think that it goes back to the flying analogy that anybody can fly when the weather's good and when everything works. But on that day where it's stormy and you have a hydraulic failure, the crew makes the difference.
So, 100%.
Yeah. When the real estate market is going up like it has been for the last 10 years, it makes a lot of people look like geniuses. But a lot of what we do is uncover track record and unearth track record to see what's really happening under the hood. You know, what do the operations actually look like? So how much is that performance that you may have done actually due to your efforts or what was due to just a screaming market?
Who's on your team that prevents these types of things? Like who have you surrounded yourself with to prevent what happened in Houston at Bardown?
So we are very good at componentizing parts of the business and putting people in charge of different parts of the business that they're really good at. So my partner, Ashley Wilson, is amazing at operations, asset management. That's what she is tasked to doing. And when it comes down to making an operational decision or an asset management decision, it's not a democracy in the company. Obviously, we all have input. We can all say what we want. But at the end of the day, she's tasked with doing the right thing and making the right decision. And she ultimately makes that decision. On the underwriting side, it's my partner, Kyle, and I. and we basically make all the underwriting decisions, and we're both very conservative, and it drives Ashley nuts. We say no to a lot of deals that she would probably jump on in a heartbeat, because she's a little bit more aggressive than we are. But at the end of the day, she recognizes that that's our part of the business, the underwriting and the due diligence. And so if we say no, it's a no, and she's not going to argue that. And so what we've gotten really good at is figuring out who the right decision maker is and ensuring that they have the authority and the berth to be able to make those decisions without question at the end of the day. And so for us, we have a relatively small team, four partners. Ashley and I are kind of the two main partners. Then we have two kind of board of director type partners, folks that keep us accountable, make sure that we're doing the right thing for our investors, doing the right thing for the long-term growth of the company. So it's the four of us, and then we have four or five other employees.
I'm going to steal Ryan's question here and ask, have you ever invested passively with other operators?
Often. So I have right now, I was either 13 or 14 LP investments right now. And that's in the real estate space. And so I also invest, obviously, outside of real estate in the business space. But yeah, in the real estate space, I do. And I do it because I recognize that, one, I love real estate. I know real estate well. I think it's a great vehicle to build wealth. But at the same time, even though we invest a good bit in our own deals, we're not diversified. I mean, I own multifamily in three cities. And the cities are probably pretty highly correlated in terms of risks. If something were to happen to the market, and the market were going to drop, they'd probably drop in all three of those cities. So I invest as an LP for that diversification. So I invest with other operators. I invest in other asset classes. I invest in other locations, other markets. I invest in other exit strategies. So we do a lot of value add. And so we diversify across new construction and stabilized properties in other types of deals. And then we diversify across different types of risks. So we invest in Houston as a market that's highly susceptible to storms. So we do some investment in areas that tend to be not at all susceptible to things like weather and natural disaster type risks.
And this is the beauty of syndication, right? Because you couldn't, you know, as incredibly talented as you are in real estate, there's no way that you would have the time or the physical ability to get to those places to participate actively in all of those activities, right?
100%. I mean, if I wanted to invest in self-storage, as smart as I might think I am, and as much as I might be able to learn in a year or two, I'm not going to learn as much about storage as you guys. That's just, it's not something I'm going to be able to do. And why should I try? I'm really good at what I do. Why shouldn't I just find somebody else who's just as good at what they do and trust them, as opposed to me trying to spread myself too thin and becoming a jack of all trades and ending up becoming a master of none?
Yeah, I love how you're like a real investor. A real investor invests at all points in the cycle, invests in diversified asset classes, invests in what they know, invests and recognizes what they don't, and is able to find good opportunities. I wanted to kind of switch gears a little bit about angel investing, because I know that we talk a lot about real estate investing, and you know, sometimes a new investor might think that real estate investing is risky, which it is. But if you really want to get risky, you do angel investing. You know, I like to hang out in the community of Seattle. I go to some angel investing meetups, and you know, we're talking 50x, 100x your money versus, you know, 2x your money in real estate over five. And, you know, you look at real estate and you might think, wow, it's really risky. We're buying this self-storage or apartment or whatever it might be. But, you know, you're investing in companies and sort of ideas that have a tendency to fail. But if they hit big. I really want to pull on this thread. What are your thoughts on that angel investing?
Yeah. So before I do that, let me go back to real estate, because I think it's very applicable and it's interesting to think about the differences in real estate. One of the reasons I love real estate is because the economic cycle, as long as you're really good at avoiding those catastrophic type risks, there's not a lot of risk in real estate. I'm not going to say there's none. I mean, obviously people lose properties all the time, but it's relatively low. And the reason for that is because a typical real estate investment is designed to be 3, 5, 7, 10, 12 years. A typical recession is going to last 6 to 18 months. Even the Great Recession of 2008, we were at about 18 to 24 months. So when you have an investment that is structured to last for 5 or 10 years, you can withstand. In fact, you should be able to withstand, because we have a recession historically every 5 or 6 years. You should expect to have to withstand a recession during that period of time. So as long as you're cash flowing well, as long as you're generating more cash than you're spending, you can withstand those negative periods. So maybe it's a expected 5-year hold, and you get towards 5 years and you hit a recession. What do? You hold another 2 or 3 or 5 years. Presumably you're making cash flow, so it's not a big deal. It's just lengthens the time of the investment. And it's one of the reasons why I tell people now's a great time to invest in real estate, because while the market sucks right now, in 5 years, it's most likely going to be a really good market, and that's when you're planning to sell. So that's real estate. In the angel investing world, in the business world, typically when you're investing in these startup companies, they don't have cash flow. They're all expenses at this point. And the money that they have to spend on those expenses is being raised through their angel investors or their venture capitalists. They don't have any natural income coming in. And so they have what's called a runway. In real estate, as long as you're generating more every month than what you're spending, you can hold the property for 100 years and you're not going to run out of money. But in the business world, you have this thing called a runway, which is if you have $1 million and you're spending $100,000 a month negative, then you've got 10 months before you run out of money. And every company knows what their runway is. They know how much time they have before they run out of money. And they have two choices before they run out of money. They either need to raise more money or they need to get profitable. And typically getting profitable takes several years, if that. I mean, a lot of companies can go decades without being profitable because they're continuing to grow. So the exit strategy, or the short-term exit strategy for a lot of these companies, is to raise more money for that next runway. And so when we get into a time like now where the market is kind of softening and people are not really looking to invest, now's the worst time to be raising money. So there are a lot of startup companies out there that have a great product, a great plan, a great team, but they don't have enough runway. And when they run out of money, they're not going to be able to raise more money. And it's not like that great plan or great team or great product is going to keep them afloat. The only thing that's going to keep them afloat is to be able to raise more money, and there's not going to be enough money out there. And so that's where the risk is with a lot of these businesses. Again, you can align yourself with the best teams, the best products, the best plans, but if they don't have enough money to get them to where they need to go, they're going to go out of business. And a lot of great companies go out of business just because they run out of money and the economy is at a point where they just can't raise more.
The risks and the opportunities, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the other thing. Typically, if you get in at that early stage before they're generating any income, like you said, we're not talking about getting a 2x return in 5 years, which in real estate is great. You're getting your 20% average annual returns. Everybody's happy. Nobody's happy with a 2x return in the business world. Few people are happy with a 10x return. You're looking for that 100, that 500, even 1,000 time return for some companies. And that's what you're betting on, because you're going to lose money on 50 or 60% of your bets. Your goal is to break even on 20 or 30 or 40% of your bets, so that 10 or 20% of your bets, you're going to make your 10 or 50 or 100 or 500 times return.
Man, when you started talking about angel investing, you lit up. Like you love this stuff. I think that's so cool. You're very
passionate. I do because it's so much more qualitative than real estate, which is quantitative.
Right.
You can stick an underwriting in front of me, and I can pretty much tell you whether a good group is going to be able to execute on that plan. A decent group is going to be able to execute on that plan. In the business world, you can stick the worst product in front of me, and I know that a great operator, a great CEO, a great team is going to be successful, because they'll figure out how to pivot on that product. They'll get rid of the product and they'll find a new product, or they'll figure out an audience or a market for that product. So in real estate, it really boils down to you need the right product and a good team. In the business world, if you have a great team, nothing else matters.
Yeah.
So I wasn't going to ask this question for real estate, the whole how you got into it, but I'm going to ask you for this. How did you get into angel investing, and how do you suggest other people might explore it?
I'm trying to think back to my first angel investment. It actually was back when I was in the tech world, and I had a friend that was, he was looking to start his company, and I knew nothing about angel investing, but I knew he was trying to raise a couple $100,000, and he was just coming to some friends and he said, "Hey, do you want to invest?" And I said, well, sure, why not? And I gave him some money. I ended up losing that money, like I've done on a lot. I could say I only lost money on one real estate deal. I've lost a lot of money on a lot of angel investments, but that's the nature of the game. But that's where it started. And after I gave him the money, I was like, I should probably figure out like what terms I should be asking for, how much stock I should be getting, what this investment should look like. And so I started researching and I realized, wow, this is an interesting investing strategy. And again, this is before I ever even thought about real estate. And so from there, I actually ended up doing some mergers and acquisition stuff and working with some venture capital firms. And I ended up working for a company that ended up selling for nearly $1 billion. So I got to see the inside of what like the for lack of a better term, mergers and acquisitions looked like in the tech world and the business world. And I got to see like the multiples that these companies trade for and how well the investors that got in early did. And it got me really excited. If I can find a company like this that I can get in early, literally I can 100 times my money, 1,000 times my money, I can retire on one company. And what I've realized since then is it's really hard to find those companies. And at the end of the day, you've got to hit a bunch of doubles and triples because that's where the money's made. But it got me excited just kind of falling into this one investment to learn how the business works. And from there, I started seeking out investments and still do.
Could you point to a couple of books or podcasts that if somebody's listening to this and they're like, this lights me up.
Before you answer though, Jay, you wrote a book, two books in 2013. You wrote a book in 2018, 2019, 2020. So you're past due for a book. And it sounds like your next book needs to be on angel investing and everything that you need to learn.
There we go.
You're here to hear.
Well, allow me to correct you on one thing. I did just release a book about 6 months ago.
Oh, okay. Cool. Okay.
Called Real Estate by the Numbers. And it's basically all the math and finance that go into investing. And my co-author is Dave Meyer, VP of Analytics at Bigger Pockets. And awesome book.
I thought that came out in 2020. I thought that
was, that was about 6 months ago. I started writing it in 2020.
Oh,
actually 2018. It took 5 years.
Yeah. Wow. And by the way, I just want to give your books a little shout out here. If you're a pilot and you're thinking about like getting into rehabbing, flipping, whatever, your books are fantastic on that. And it's the,
I appreciate that.
Yeah. The book on flipping, the book on estimating rehab costs. And what are the other two?
The book on negotiating real estate and recession-proof real estate investing.
Yeah, but like estimating rehab costs, like incredible book. So if you haven't read it, we'll put a link into the show notes to Amazon. You can go buy it. It's like perfect deck car reviews. Everybody loves that book. So excellent. Even if you're doing a home renovation, great for that.
Got it right behind me. And if you're listening to this, you're not watching it on YouTube, Jay has an entire bookshelf and wall behind him of all of his authorship.
I do that because I give away a lot of books. So I have to keep them in stock.
Awesome. We have a question from one of our listeners. We talked about
you. Well, and before we get to that, you went and grabbed a book from your bookshelf before we get off angel investing.
Yeah. So if anybody wants to learn about angel investing, there's really only one good book out there. It's called Angel, actually. And it's by a guy named Jason Calcanis. And he was an early angel in Uber. That's kind of his claim to fame. For anybody that listens, there's a podcast out there called the All In Podcast, which is a really good business podcast. But he's the host of that. And he's got a good book. And he also has a angel investing group out there for accredited investors. Where he can actually like help you find deals. And
amazing. That's perfect.
Yeah.
All right. And well, now we can switch gears.
I also wanted to just say too, if you're thinking about how to get into angel investing and you're not in the tech world like Jay was, even if you, after you read that book that Jay recommended, I just went on Meetup and found this group called Keretsu Forum, and they're pretty good. I actually haven't made any moves, but I am just learning. And I signed up for a year, went to all their meetups, and watched companies pitch their opportunity to invest in them. And so I learned a ton about angel investing doing that. So pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, what I'll remind everybody who thinks about getting into angel investing, it's just like when people get into real estate and they start looking at deals and they're like, oh, this looks like a good deal. And this looks like a good deal. And everything looks like a good deal because you don't know what you're really looking at. And then when you get really good at it, you realize, yeah, 1 out of 100 deals is a good deal. It's the same thing in angel investing. You're going to talk to some founders who are going to be really good at convincing you that they've got the next best thing and they're the greatest thing since sliced bread and they've got the best team and they've got the best product and all that. And what you're going to realize after a couple years of doing it is that, yeah, it's pretty much the same. 1 out of 100 is going to be good. And the hard part is going to be figuring out what that 1 out of 100 is.
And that's the riskiest money you can invest. So if you're like just getting into investing, I mean, I'm not giving financial advice, but that is you're going off the deep end. Like if you're angel investing, like you are doing the most risk you can possibly take in a deal. So just FYI, biggest reward, biggest risk.
And it can be the most demoralizing investment you ever make as well, because let's say you put $5,000 into an angel investment or $10,000 into an angel investment. A year later or 2 years later, they're raising money at a much higher valuation. And on paper, your $10,000 investment now looks like it's worth $300,000. And so when you're filling out your personal financial statement that you're using to get your bank loans, you can legally, because they actually have to tell you what the valuation of the stock is, you can legally say my $10,000 is now worth $350,000. And then 6 months later, that company goes out of business and you have to go to your financial statement. And now you see $350,000 just wiped off your net worth. And it's the worst feeling in the world.
Yeah, that's great.
We always say that real estate is get rich slow, but it's get rich for sure.
Yeah.
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 100%.
Excellent. Well, switching gears a little bit from angel investing, we did actually have a couple of people write in because we put out there that you were going to be on the show. And a lot of, you know, our audience is primarily airline pilots making, you know, 250 to 600 grand a year, usually have an investment property or two. A lot of it probably needs a renovation. So one of the questions we got from a couple of people was, hey, what would Jay recommend in terms of estimating a rehab? And you know, I know this is kind of a broad question, but we'll kind of take it where you want to go in terms of estimating how much it's going to cost, finding a good contractor and actually executing on that.
Yeah. So it's such a tough question. And I'm never one to say, buy my book. But really,
buy his book.
Let me talk a little bit about, and don't think you're going to buy the book and it's going to tell you how much it's going to cost.
Right.
Because when it comes to how much things cost, it's going to depend on how old's the house, how high end of finishes you want, what market you're in, what types of stores you shop at from the labor side, what types of contractors you use. Do they carry insurance or do you pick them up down at Home Depot? I mean, there's so many things that impact the cost of labor materials. But what the book will teach you and what I can talk a little bit about here is that there's a methodology and it's important to learn the methodology. And the way I like to think of it is, a house is made up of lots of components. And so you have things like the roof, you have the siding, you have the framing, you have the kitchen, the cabinets, you have the countertops, you have the flooring, you have the paint, you have the plumbing, the electrical, the HVAC. At the end of the day, I break it down into 25 components. And each of these components in the property, when you go to look at a property, are going to be in one of three conditions. One, they're going to be just fine and you don't have to do anything. Two, they're going to be non-functional. Something's going to be broken and you're going to have to fix it for safety reasons or functional reasons. Or three, it's going to be working, but it's going to be out of date and you have to fix it for cosmetic reasons. And so what you need to do is you need to be able to walk through a house. And for each of these 25 components, you need to say, let's take the roof, for example. For the roof, you need to be able to say, is the roof in good shape? Is it functional? Can I leave it? Or do I need to spend money on it? And if I need to spend money on it, do I need to spend money to make it functional? Or do I need to spend money to make it more aesthetically appealing? And roof is a bad example for aesthetics. We don't replace roof for aesthetics. But basically, you need to decide, you need to inspect the roof and determine, do I need to replace the roof? Do I need to repair the roof? And you can do this for each of the things in your house. You can go look at the kitchen cabinets and say, well, they look fine, but if you have a designer that comes in and says, yeah, these are out of date and you need to update the style, then you may need to replace them. And so for each of the 25 components, you need to decide, do we keep it or do we fix it or do we replace it? And then for all the things that are not keep, all the things that are fix or replace, you need to figure out what's the material cost to do that and what's the labor cost to do that. So at the end of the day, you're going to have 25 components. Within each component, you might have a list of 10 or 15 or 20 different things that you look at that you're either going to need to fix or replace. And then you're going to have to assign a labor and a material price for each of those things. Once you have that line item of 5 or 50 or 500 things that you need to fix or replace, and you assign a labor and a material cost for each of those 500 things, you add them up and there's your estimate. Now, a lot of people ask, how do I walk into a house for the first time and decide what's working, what's not working? What I like to say is there are two people you want to hire. One, a good home inspector. The home inspector is going to go in and tell you the things that are not functional. They're going to tell you the things that you have to fix because they're not working. This doorknob doesn't work. The dishwasher doesn't work. The plumbing is corroded and doesn't work. The electrical is old aluminum wiring. You have to replace that. Whatever it is, they're going to tell you the things that don't work. And then secondarily, you want to bring in a designer, somebody that knows, it could be a real estate agent that knows a little bit of design. It could be a stager. It could be an actual designer. But somebody who can come in and tell you, I don't care if it's working or not, but that paint color is horrendous. And those kitchen countertops are out of style. That pink toilet needs to go. You need to replace the light fixtures. Basically, all the things that are aesthetically unpleasing that need to be replaced. And between all the non-functional things that the inspector tells you and all the aesthetic things that the designer tells you, that's your list of things that you need to replace. And again, for each of those, you need a labor price, a material price. You add them up and there's your estimate.
When you were flipping all those 400 houses, did you shop for your materials and have them dropped off at the site?
Yeah. So I'm a big fan of, I leave as little to chance as possible. So I don't like my contractors picking my materials. I want my contractors to be great at replacing things and fixing things. I don't expect them to be great at figuring out what light fixture I want or what light fixture goes with that plumbing fixture or what color paint goes with these cabinets or this flooring. So at the end of the day, I have full control of my materials. Now, who buys them? If my painter says I can get a much better price at Sherwin-Williams than you can, great, you buy the paint. But here's the color.
Right.
I'm gonna dictate what the specific material is. If I'm gonna go buy lighting fixtures, and my electrician says, "Hey, I have a supplier that can provide those same fixtures, but at a cheaper price," great, you go buy them. But again, these need to be the fixtures. So I want to dictate what the materials are. As for who buys them, that's going to be whatever the cheapest is. But typically what we do at the beginning of the project is we'll make a list of all the materials that we need. We'll figure out where we're buying them from, and we'll place big orders. We'll get them shipped to the property. We might put them in a pod. We might put them in the garage. We might put them in the living room. But we want everything there on site the day the project starts, because the worst thing in the world is having a contractor that says, I can't keep working because I'm stopped because you haven't gotten me the materials. It's hard enough to keep a contractor actually moving forward. You don't want to give him any good excuse for not doing so. So I like to make sure all materials are on site as of day one, so that my contractors never have an excuse about what to use or having it available to start.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Thanks for that thoughtful answer. That's really good. I know that we're getting to the close to the end here, and I did want to talk about, you know, Jay, there's lots of noise on Facebook, but I love your posts, and they're really thoughtful. You kind of talked a lot about the bond market and its failure and its impact that it could have, kind of called that a little bit almost. And you've also been kind of an OG in content and thought leadership in real estate. Now everybody is a thought leader because they've got ChatGPT. So, but like Jay's been doing it for real for like 10 plus years. So, writing books and things like that. So with that kind of background, you know, what keeps you up at night? What is your concern right now about where things are going? Or, you know, you can go most excited, but you know, but maybe let's talk about what kind of keeps you up at night first.
Probably the political climate. Our economy I think our economy is likely headed for a worsening recession over the next 6 to 12 months. I don't think it's going to be a 2008 type event, but recessions are never fun. People lose their jobs, people make less money, get their hours cut, lose their houses. So it's never good. But I think the political climate is one of those things that the economic stuff will resolve itself. Give it a few months or years, it'll resolve itself. The political stuff just seems to be getting worse and worse, and we seem to be a lot more polarized. And I think that the political stuff can easily start to bleed over into the economic issues. And we're seeing that now with the debt ceiling. So I don't know when this episode is coming out. I know we're live right now on a couple of platforms, but if you're going to release it later, this may not be an issue. The debt ceiling may already be resolved, but we're down to a day and a half away from basically running out of money if we don't agree, both sides agree to raising the debt ceiling. And the amount of people that I see from both sides saying, hey, we shouldn't be negotiating, let's let it fail, is just crazy, because I don't think people recognize what's going to happen if we don't come to an agreement on the debt ceiling. If not in the next day and a half, at least in the next couple of weeks, we could literally be destroying our economy forever. If we basically can't pay our bills, if we can't pay our debt, that's going to impact the U.S. dollar. U.S. dollar is currently the reserve currency. We're likely to be the reserve currency for a good while longer, just because there's nothing out there right now that competes. But if people lose faith in the U.S. dollar, there's going to be a competitor that emerges pretty quickly. And so I don't think people realize that this political infighting could potentially lead to ramifications that could really hurt all of us, not just the next year or two or five, but forever.
If you could wave your wand in policy on that, what would you do?
Well, I mean, with respect to the specific question of raise the debt ceiling, we're not going to fix the economy or all of our economic problems in this country in the next day and a half. So yeah, you're right. You agree to raise the debt ceiling. But at the end of the day, I'm a big believer in common sense. And so I think there's a couple things we need to do. One, we need to spend less money. And a lot of people say, well, what are we going to cut? Well, there's a lot of things we can cut. There's a lot of wasted money in this country. And you look at, you break down the budget, and it's not hard to find hundreds of millions of dollars there. So number one, I mean, just like in my house, if I'm running out of money, what am I going to do? I'm going to spend less, number one. And number two, I'm going to try and make more. I have no problem with strategic raising of taxes, of closing of some loopholes. And let me tell you something, I'm probably one of those people, a lot of people would say I'm wealthy and I take advantage of those loopholes. I don't pay a lot of taxes because I have a ton of depreciation and I'm a real estate professional, so I can offset all of my income from these multifamily properties I'm buying. But if somebody said to me, hey, you can't get away with paying zero taxes, I'd be okay with that. As long as I knew my money was going someplace good, as long as I knew my money wasn't being wasted. So I think the first thing is we need to revamp the budget in such a way that people actually can buy into what we're spending money on. People can say, I'm okay with my tax dollars going there. If we can do that, number one, then I think more people are going to be okay with raising taxes a little bit. I'm not saying 70% tax bracket for the wealthy. Anything over 100 million gets taken by the government, all those ridiculous things. But I think there are some common sense ways of closing some loopholes, raising some taxes strategically, where if the money is going towards things that we can all agree are the things we should be spending money on, we're not going to have the pushback that a lot of people think. And so at the end of the day, it's a budget. It's no different than your budget at home. You need to make more money and you need to spend less money. And then here's the other big thing. The best way to make more money for the government is to increase GDP. To increase productivity, to increase output. And at the end of the day, the reason why the U.S. has been such a powerhouse for the last 100 years, economically, politically, militarily, is because of innovation, is because we figured out how to propel our economy forward through increased output. And we did it with machines back in the 30s and 40s. Did it with technology in the 90s, and since the 90s, we're likely going to do it with AI over the next 10 years. We're going to figure out ways to radically increase productivity, which is going to radically increase profits for companies, which is going to just increase GDP, which is going to allow us to collect more money without hurting people. And so I think increasing productivity over the next 5 or 10 years should be the single biggest priority for the government. How do you do that? You encourage education, you encourage businesses, and that's where we get into that kind of push and pull between raising taxes but still encouraging businesses to operate. But I think we should be doing everything we can to really foster this idea of innovation and productivity, because that's how you get out of these long-term economic spirals and debt spirals.
No, I love it.
Definitely.
Jay Scott, yeah. When are you going to run for mayor?
For mayor?
Congress. I think Congress.
Senator.
That's a very, that's a good senator kind of name, Jay Scott. I like it.
I'm way too independent and middle of the road. Nobody.
No, we need more people like that.
I agree, but unfortunately, too many people don't.
All right. Well, Jay, I would
hate to have to associate my name with either party.
Yeah, I know exactly.
That's fair. Sure,
because we're keeping a lot of people on the sidelines. Well, yep. Jay, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing with our listeners all the great things and continuing to just add tremendous amount of value to me personally and the real estate community and the investing community.
Very well
said. Do we have ways people can get in touch with you or learn more about you or kind of just do research on things?
Yeah, easiest way, www.connectwithjscott.com. And that's my link tree, and it'll link out my emails there, and my websites are there, and anything you want to find out is there.
Okay, just the letter J, right? No A-Y.
I registered both, oh, so okay. J or J, okay. Just the letter J, but if you put J-A-Y, you'll still get it.
You're a tech guy. Yeah, you thought through it all. I love it. Well, thanks, Jay, for coming on, and thanks for tuning in, everybody. We'll catch you on the next episode.
Catch you on the next one. Thanks again, Jay.